Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, June 29th, 2018. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's Casual Friday, folks. I am wearing my soft-collared shirt, as is the case on Fridays. Pair of Zumbas. Joining me in studio today for Casual Friday, Nomiki Konst.
Hi. Not casual.
Also on the program, Country Braces for the Supreme Court and Handmaid's Tale crossover episode. Meanwhile, in a Baltimore, five dead in a shooting at a local newspaper. ICE agents join the Abolish ICE movement. And over 550 people arrested in protests in the Capitol, protesting the U.S. policy of kidnapping immigrant children. And as the State Department releases a report that says its so-called child separation program increases trafficking, mass protests tomorrow. More information at familiesbelongtogether.org. New reports, Trump undercutting the EU and, I don't know if I have a problem with this, the WTO. And speaking of civility, there are still nearly two dozen states in this country where you can get fired for being gay, as half of LGBTQ folks not out at work. All this and more on today's program. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, in studio with us today, and it's always fun to have people in studio. Nomiki Konst, she is an advisor to Our Revolution, formerly TYT. And also, you sat or sit on the commission. What is the technical name for this commission?
The technical name is... the DNC, Democratic National Committee, Unity Reform Commission.
Okay, and this was a commission that was set up at the 2016. Oh, Jesus Christ. It was 2 years ago.
It was.
DNC to basically reform some of the practices of the DNC that people had issue with, obviously, and larger issues, and with the way that they were running the primary, in that it was exclusionary. And there was some news this week, so very fortuitous to have you in studio.
I was supposed to be here last week, and then I canceled on you for...
And it's better. It's better, stuff. Because now we have you after this has been resolved. Plus, I also have to say... you're the first person I think we've ever had in studio who, like, even had the consciousness of saying, which one is my camera? I think...
And you know what? I don't even realize I'm on camera right now. That's the bad part. Well, I'm checking my phone.
No, that's exactly the way we roll here. Michael Brooks generally sits there and...
checks his phone.
People are very concerned if he's not checking his phone. All right. I want to get into that stuff, but let's start the show off because you're also you've been heavily involved in New York politics for years.
Yeah.
And I want to just start with this clip we have of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's already a national figure.
I can't believe this is amazing.
And she was on Colbert last night, explaining what her democratic socialism, or what democratic socialism, I should say, means to her. This is clip number two, and Let's hear that now.
Democratic districts. So there's a good shot that you're going to go to Congress, while not guaranteed. You said
pause it for 1 second. We should just say that her opponent in the general election, the Republican, he is a men's rights advocate.
He's also raised zero money. That was a story today. Zero donations in the last week.
People don't want to bet on a losing horse.
Yes. Well, wait till this message of men's rights advocacy gets out. And so before we judge. But here is Colbert.
Reality, you might be able to get people to get on board with your agenda. What is your agenda? Because you describe yourself as a democratic socialist. And that's not an easy term for a lot of Americans. What is the meaning of that for you? What does socialist mean to you?
For me, democratic socialism is about really... The value for me is that I believe that in a modern, moral, and wealthy society, no person in America should be too poor to live. That's what I think.
That seems simple.
Seems pretty simple. So what that means to me is healthcare as a human right. It means that every child, no matter where you are born, should have access to a college or trade school education if they so choose it. And, I think that no person should be homeless if we can have public structures and public policy to allow for people to have homes and food and lead a dignified life in the United States.
Super scary stuff. Super scary stuff. And there she is on Colbert. And Jamie, you were saying that in the wake of her election, there was a huge surge in DSA membership.
Yeah. I see this is a very, definitely verified tweet from a Washington Post reporter. He said, the Democratic Socialists of America report their biggest single day jump in membership ever, following Ocasio 2018's victory Tuesday, with over 1,000 people joining in 24 hours. And it was our biggest bump ever so far, bigger than the bump after Trump's election, as well as the bump after Disrupt J20, right around similar time, which was about 800 each. And we're now over 40,000 members.
Wow, that's double, I feel like it was,
nationwide,
in 2016.
Which is just fucking crazy and cool as hell. And, you know, I've been an electoral skeptic in the past in terms of how these kinds of tactics are going to serve our long-term horizon of transitioning to a socialist society built around human needs and not profits. But one key goal, and I just reread the electoral strategy document, so I made sure I knew what I was talking about. Like, one really important task facing us right now is to build our base and make contact with more of the working class. And that is clearly happening based on our work with Ocasio-Cortez. And I hope it'll continue to happen. So got to give credit where credit's due.
And where, I mean, Nomi, from your perspective, like, where does this fit in terms of New York politics? I mean, what are the implications for New York politics seem to me to be pretty big when you're looking at Cynthia Nixon, who's running against Cuomo? How much impact does it have in terms of New York?
It was earth shattering. I'll give you an example. Other than the fact that the Speaker, Cory Johnson, came out. And this is New York politics is like 12-dimensional chess. So bear with me a little bit. But I know people love process. It's real fun right now. It's
right.
Like the new it thing. DSA just sits there for 3 hours and talks process. It's great, actually. But that's where all the stuff is hidden, is in the process. So the new speaker of the city council got his position through Joe Crowley. Who's also the head of the Queen's machine, right? Mm-hmm. The Queen's Democratic machine, which is very important in New York politics. Joe Crowley was one of the signers on this Independent Democratic Conference deal to make those. He backed the IDC, essentially.
Okay, and let me just tell people, the IDC is a group of like eight Democrats, ostensibly Democrats, who caucus with the Republicans, really in exchange. I mean, it's sort of amazing how brazen it is. It's literally in exchange for money.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to give you a bigger office. We're going to give you resources. And New York politics is the line between... I'm not familiar with the laws, but it feels like you can get money for your office as a state senator and use it to buy yourself stuff. I mean, it basically feels like
larger offices. You know, the communications director of the IDC, who now works for the Republicans, she was getting paid more than twice what the senators were being paid.
Yeah, it's shocking. It's just a huge slush fund that they were just given to caucus with the Republicans. And Andrew Cuomo not only sort of gave his blessing, but almost like midwifed it.
He invented the IDC and actually designed it.
And this was a way for him to avoid having to ever sign legislation that two houses of Democrats in New York State, a fairly liberal state, would be sending him, because he didn't want to taint his future prospects as a president, ostensibly thinking that he was going to run in 1993, I guess.
And not to mention, it's not just that he was doing this you know, 90s era-esque Clintonian game, right? Triangulation. He also was using the fact that the Senate was holding up the Republican-led Senate, because these Democrats were caucusing the Republicans. He was using them to block any sort of ethics reform. We have the loosest campaign finance laws in this country. So he is taking advantage of these things called the LLC loopholes, which basically LLCs can give an extraordinary amount of money. You can set up 150 LLCs. Now, who does that? Real estate interests do that.
Yes.
And so he has been raising. He's $31 million in his coffers. There is a legal way for him to use that money and move it into a super PAC to support his presidential campaign.
Right.
And that is what is being buried in all of this noise. But just to go back to your original point, because this is really important, how democratic socialism has affected New York State and how it's going to affect the DNC. Cory Johnson, the speaker, who's young, he's openly gay, LGBTQ, he has AIDS, he's HIV positive.
Okay.
So he's been very open about his experience and transformative. He went out and he backed the no IDC candidates, all the candidates running against the IDC members, going against Joe Crowley, who got him his position just a few months ago.
Wow. Okay.
So that happened just 2 days ago, right? I had a meeting with a lawmaker in New York State. There's a lot of lawmakers, so I don't want to give this away. But somebody who you would never think in a million years would ask me this. First thing this person said to me when I sat down and had coffee with him yesterday, because everybody wants to understand who she is.
Right.
He says, I'd like to join DSA. I said, what? You know, they now see it as, oh my gosh, it's this
imprimatur that is going to, right.
They're going to organize for us, but the politics weren't that far off. It's just, it was such a foreign concept. And frankly, what Joe Crowley, he received all these endorsements from unions, and the unions have been a line of defense for these machine politicians, but they didn't deliver. And it's not that the union members didn't deliver. The union leadership is very different in New York State. It's complicated. It's
very highly transactional. And so you'll see, and we saw this with Zephyr Teachout's run, and we see this with Cynthia Nixon's run against Cuomo. They make a calculation we cannot afford, because of highly transactional nature and opaque nature of the politics. We can't afford to mess with Cuomo, because he will... And down the line, he will screw us.
And he has in the past.
Yep. Yep.
He went out in an all-out war against unions just 6 years ago after he was elected. Teachers unions in particular. There were... The teachers union in New York had put up billboards calling out Andrew Cuomo for being against unions and teachers. And now they have a friendship again.
Sure.
It's a very complicated relationship. So I wouldn't... you know, the unions aren't supporting or turning people out. I don't know if that's intentional or if it's just the weakening of unions because of Andrew Cuomo, but it's essentially hurting even the establishment Democrats who rely on them for support.
And so there are people sort of fishing around for another base of like that will generate boots on the ground, essentially, and do this work. I mean, what level of, I mean, because you spend a lot of time with politicians like this, how sophisticated are they? Like how, or I should, let me put it this way. I don't want to ask how stupid are most of them, but It strikes me that that's the way the calculation is. It's like, oh, that is a shiny thing over there that looks like it could work for me. And there's no other implications, really, or it's just like, how can I position myself? Because I feel to a certain extent, we see a lot of this, broadly speaking, in the Democratic Party.
Right.
And I just don't pay attention to the Republican Party in the same way, although I think that they are actually the lunatics now run the asylum in the Republican Party. For decades, I think that they would kowtow to them. And then at one point, they just became them. In the Democratic Party, at least from my perspective,
lunatics run our asylum too.
Well, yes,
they run the chessboard,
but they're different ones, right? I mean, like they do not the base is pushing the party to the left, mm-hmm. in a way that it has not in at least in the better part of my lifetime, and certainly the more so in the past 5-10 years than I've saw, you know, in the decades before that. Mm-hmm. How much of it is even like an awareness of what they're adopting, or how much of it is just like, this is where the energy is, I'm going there?
I think that for those who have political ambitions, and it's not going to cost them anything right now, and a perfect example would be all these more neoliberal, younger senators who are lining up for Medicare for All and for Bernie's policies. It really doesn't cost them anything right now because
They don't have to take a vote, right?
Yeah, exactly. They're not the majority, and it looks good, and it gets, you know, a younger group of voters. It's when they do things like, say, they're no longer taking corporate money or they're no longer taking pharmaceutical money that I think that's where we're really attacking the root. And that has happened in the Senate with the Democrats, with some of them. But I think we're winning the moral argument right now, as Alex Ocasio-Cortez just said. I think we're winning the issues arguments right now, even across the board with Republicans too, across demographics. When you talk about economics and income inequality, it affects, you know, pretty much everybody in this country. The electoral, I think why this was so transformative is because you could not identify two more difficult places to run for office than the Bronx and Queens in terms of the machine. And Alex Ocasio-Cortez annihilated somebody who was being chosen to be the next speaker, most likely,
right.
Because not just because he raised money, not because he was like some sort of likable guy, because he was very good at controlling people, but he couldn't even control his own machine.
Right. That's interesting. I mean, this is a guy who had real skills. This is not an unskilled politician.
Oh, yeah.
And how much do you think he was aware that this was happening? I mean, it wasn't like the David Bratt, Eric Cantor thing, where I think like Eric Cantor showed up in his district 3 weeks before the election and was like, hey, wait a second, what's going on here? I feel like Crowley has been aware of this as a problem for at least like 3 or 4 months, at least.
I think yes and no. I mean, I think that they were worried about her breaking past maybe like 30% and embarrassing him as he went into the speaker or the,
right.
you know, whatever race he's, depending on what happens in the House, right? But let's not forget, and I tweeted about this yesterday, about how journalists go to elected officials for electoral advice or strategy. And a lot of these elected officials, Cuomo, Crowley, not everybody, they walked into their seats. Schumer's different, actually. Schumer hustled his way in.
Right.
He fought. And you can see it sometimes. It comes out. He has a sense of where the wind is blowing. I don't agree with a lot of his policies and who backs him, but he does have a sense of where the wind is blowing on the ground. Crowley inherited that seat. He was a staffer for the previous congressman. And the way that New York politics works is most, 7 out of 10, I think, elected officials end up inheriting their seats by county committee, because the county committee basically decides who the Democratic nominee is going to be when there's a special election. And there are a lot of special elections in New York for corruption, for retirement, a whole bunch of reasons. And that's what, you know, he inherited the seat. He's never had a real opposition. He basically lives in Virginia. As Alex Ocasio-Cortez says, he doesn't drink the water. His kids don't go to our schools. So there's a disconnect. And, you know, that meeting I went to with that lawmaker the other day, and he's a good guy. He's actually very progressive, so I shouldn't, you know, he's not like all other politicians. He asked me my perspective after we kind of broke down the numbers. He said, it's like when a farmer is on a farm and they feel that day the previous year it was 2 degrees cooler. real sophisticated politicians know when things are moving just by the slightest degree. And those are people who are connected to the roots. Those are people who know what their voters are like. Those are people who go around in their neighborhoods and talk to the business owners. Those are people who are listening. And that's what Alex was paying attention to. Joe Crowley had no clue what the temperature was like in his district at all. Last year, the year before, the last 15 years.
I mean, I sort of feel that's a perfect metaphor for someone like Nancy Pelosi with the entire caucus, and not just the entire caucus, the entire party. Because in the main, I am supportive of Nancy Pelosi. I think, you know, in her capacity as both a majority and a minority leader, you know, she never took a vote that she didn't win. I mean, she knew what was going on with that caucus. But I think her sense of what's going on in national politics now, I think it is we've gone past some type of tipping point where she seems completely adrift. I think Chuck Schumer also completely adrift.
Absolutely.
And no sense of not just even and I'm just talking from just sheer political assessment and what, like the idea that they would come out with PAYGO a couple of weeks ago is just bizarre to me.
Yeah.
The idea that Chuck Schumer is talking about, you know, gas prices or afraid to get involved in the mix where we are kidnapping children at the border is insane. Like Jeff Merkley, when he went down there, it felt like he was going rogue.
Right.
And because he was
going rogue.
He was. And that is stunning that there are just opportunity after opportunity after opportunity in terms of politics. And they seem completely out of touch. And I don't know if it's just a function of you're in the leadership for too long. If you're in the leadership for too long and you're also like pushing your late 70s, early 80s with a lot of these folks, and add in the rate of change on the ground, all those things combined make it feel like they've been jettisoned into the ether and have no sense of what's going on. I mean, one of the things that I'm very encouraged about is, and Crowley, I think, sort of ironically, was probably the most in touch of the leadership of the Democratic Party. But he still was like part of that generation on some level. And that opening there creates an opening for people who are a little bit more. I just feel like sometimes you need to break that up. And I think that's pretty positive. All right. So I want to also talk to you about what you've been doing on this commission, because there's a couple of things. I mean, first tell us about let's start with this. I know you've pushed caucuses in the past. Is that right or no?
No, that was a smear campaign oh my goodness, that's how far it permeated. Oh, this drove me crazy. So during the Reform Commission, there was a very coordinated effort, funded effort, to smear members in the commission who are outspoken about reforms. And people like Joy Reid and Neera Tanden just said these things openly. I mean, I made complaints to MSNBC that none of us were actually, it wasn't one or the other. There were four areas of reform. We don't have the ability to eliminate primaries and put caucuses in. It was about reforming caucuses.
Right, this is all states.
Primaries.
This is all that states do. Right.
It was infuriating because we just kept having to set the record straight and they just kept smearing.
Well, what is is there anybody out there who's pushing caucuses over primaries?
No, absolutely not.
Okay. All right, good. Because I fell victim to that. And this notion of like, and it wasn't, I mean, a huge deal. It just didn't make sense to me. Like, why would you push a caucus? It's not necessarily any more, it doesn't seem to achieve any of the aims that anybody associated with it wants. It's less democratic. I mean, I don't think there's anything particularly wrong with them, although, you know, maybe it's like a secondary thing. But it's less democratic, and it's not necessarily open to. It almost runs contrary to the idea of like more open primaries. But we'll go to that.
Let me give you the alternative, because the irony of this was that I was being attacked for having some sort of weird caucus agenda over primaries when I actually had your perspective going in, and I was enlightened because, you know, we had these experts, you know, people who'd worked in caucus states, people. We looked at literally there were four areas that we were concerned with. Party reform, which is a big bucket, they called it. And I was on the party reform committee. Primary reform, I was involved in that because I'm from New York and it has the worst primary. Caucus reform and superdelegate reform. And so we had experts in all these areas as we traveled around the country, and we debated. I mean, this was a commission. The majority of the commission was Hillary supporter of Hillary appointees. What I learned was actually fascinating regarding caucuses. You look at the country right now, and most of the state legislatures are Republican controlled. And of those state or in our state, yeah, Republican controlled in New York. So the primary rules, the primary process is overseen by Republicans. Under caucuses, majority of caucuses are in more conservative states, some exceptions, and they need reform. All of them need reforms. But those caucuses are overseen by the Democratic Party. It's a way for the Democratic Party to kind of protect their process away from voter suppression. And there were countless examples that were used. We had legal experts come in, and it blew my mind. So I see the argument for why caucuses are important in some states. It wouldn't work in a state like New York. It wouldn't work in others, you know, Florida. But
that's interesting. And so if it's a Republican-controlled state, things like the dates of primaries, like how, like are we going to do state and
voter
federal
ID
at the same
laws.
Time? Right. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Whereas caucuses, you don't impose voter ID laws or, I mean, yeah, okay. I mean, I think there's definitely an argument for them as a secondary tool on some level, right?
And I think the arguments that people make against caucuses were all addressed in the Reform Commission. Accessibility, you know, are you disabled? You know, how long should she be there all day? We recommended a set of reforms that were, I think, profound.
And where are those reforms in the does that committee even have the ability to implement these things, or just suggestions to state parties?
They're, well, it's a little complicated. So the DNC Reform Commission, we've had several commissions in the past. In fact, superdelegates were invented at the Hunt Commission in 1981, and now they're soon going to be gone, thank goodness. But these commissions actually do a lot for the rules of the party. And it's been behind closed doors in the past, but there's been a lot of attention. So the report was issued before the Rules and Bylaws Committee. Okay. So think like Congress. This is how it works. Right. It goes from committee to committee and then goes for a final vote. So the Rules and Bylaws Committee had met for the last few months, and actually they're doing their final vote on one other thing in a few weeks, but they voted on the superdelegates issue just a few days ago, 2 days ago. Then it goes, the whole entire set of recommendations go before the larger DNC at the end of August in Chicago. And that's actually good. We were worried about the Rules and Bylaws Committee because they're all appointed and none of the Bernie people were on the Rules and Bylaws Committee.
Right. Okay.
Not one person. So we actually did fairly well there, and they wanted to take some of our recommendations further. Because don't forget, our commission was compromised. Nina Turner and I, we both voted to eliminate superdelegates, and we abstained, I should say, from the vote because we didn't believe it went far enough. And the RBC, the Rules and Bylaws Committee, actually took it further.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
And so, all right, so tell us, what is happening with superdelegates? I mean, I have to tell you that for me, outside of, like, I'm not convinced. The biggest problem with superdelegates, from my perspective, has always been that it creates a sense of momentum in the media narrative that isn't necessarily there.
Correct.
And I think that the impact of that can be overstated. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, like, you know, I mean, AOC's victory against Crowley on some level is an example of, like, the media narrative doesn't always dictate.
But the media never paid attention to that race at all.
That's true. That's
except
true.
Except for our lefty friends like The Intercept.
That's true. That's true. But with that said, I think there is, well, tell me what the reform is. Because the only value I saw out of the superdelegates was, like, let's say you have a candidate who gets indicted from June to, I mean, it shouldn't happen that way. I mean, specifically, that is, but I mean, clearly sometimes it you know, who knows? You can't count on, you get a candidate who's indicted.
Yeah.
Or, you know, there's some evidence that comes out there like, oh my God, there's video of them killing somebody. We need to stop this
or
before
worse,
the election.
Or lunch with Donald Trump.
Or having lunch with Donald Trump or whatever it is. I mean, so I think there's some, I don't know what
but
that mechanism
emails.
Is. Right. Well, yes, exactly. But the
that was an ironic joke there because that actually was an issue.
But so what is the reform, and is there still a mechanism to, like, hit the emergency brake?
Yeah. Well, there's always been a mechanism to hit the emergency brake outside of superdelegates. The chair I don't think this is the right mechanism, but the chair of the party actually has authority to like pick another candidate if they want to.
That's terrifying.
That's crazy.
To me. Right.
Especially.
Right.
Anyways, I'm going to cut that off before the vote, before the DNC.
Right.
But I mean, so superdelegates, the funny thing about this is that the intention of superdelegates in 1981 were to be just that, that they weren't supposed to declare who they were supporting until they were on the convention floor in this sort of emergency situation. I remember being on CBS News in 2016. I think it was maybe a few, 2 months before the California primary, so whatever that was, April, May. And they had, at that point, basically declared, even though it was right after New York, so they had declared the race for Hillary. And everybody was talking about superdelegates. I said, you're counting the superdelegates in the delegates, but the superdelegates don't count until the convention.
Right. They're not committed yet.
They're
not committed. Change their mind. They do all the, I mean, they've done in the past.
They've done all the past, but you can't, but it's not, it's technically against the rules.
Right.
It was already against the rules. And I got into such a debate about this, even with a political reporter there, that I had to pull up the rules of the Democratic Party and show it to them on air, because there was such a false narrative.
And was that the last time that you went on air?
No, I'm actually a contributor there.
Oh,
still.
Well, there you
and
go.
P.S. He's fired now for a Me Too scandal. I feel like I can say that out loud.
There you go. Hold on. Let's do this.
Hell yeah.
They haven't had me on, though, in a while, so.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. But now the rule is this, that yes, there's still superdelegates. And I see people on Twitter saying, well, there's still superdelegates. You haven't eliminated. There's still superdelegates, but they cannot vote on the first ballot. It's when it gets to the second ballot that they will have the ability to vote. I mean, what else are you going to do when there's a stalemate?
So basically, okay, so they only come in if it is undecided, essentially, mm-hmm. by the delegates who are actually decided by the people who voted
right.
for them.
And it's not all superdelegates. The reduction is basically, it's basically the electeds that are left, the congressional members.
Those, all right, well, those are the second ones or the first? I mean,
it's confusing, I know.
Okay, no. But, I mean, I understand. So there are two types of superdelegates generally. There are sort of like dignitaries from the Democratic Party,
right.
and then there are some who are like sitting politicians.
Yeah.
The sitting politicians get to vote in the first round, is that
no,
it? Or no?
Nobody gets to vote in the first
nobody
round.
Nobody first gets to vote. Oh, in the second round, it's only basically.
Yeah.
So the dignitaries are just now they get to like, they have a key. They get a key, we're going to give you a badge and a medal and you're a superdelegate.
Yeah.
Wink, wink, keep donating money.
Yeah.
Type of situation.
And there's been these like crazy responses that are just not, they're not based on any sort of reality. There were some racial elements that are brought up saying it protects the African-American vote. There's just no evidence of that at all. It's actually the reversal. I mean,
that's the superdelegates protect the African-American vote.
I don't really I actually haven't even heard the defense of that. I've heard the argument. I haven't heard the facts, and I was on this commission and I just kept hearing it over and over. And I said, OK, so show me the proof, because I understand why they were. It was at a time when there wasn't a black caucus in Congress.
Right.
And so I get that side of it. But one superdelegate equals 10,000 votes. So if you're reflecting the will of the voter and you're a member of the CBC, then you're actually protecting your people by actually voting with your district.
Right.
So it just didn't make sense to me. It's going to go before the DNC still for a larger vote. I think it would be crazy at this point for the DNC to vote against the RBC. It would just be a bad media situation.
It seems unlikely to me.
Yeah.
I mean, at the DNC this past night, I was talking to, is it Christine Pelosi?
Yeah.
And the first thing she talked about was like, we really do got to do this superdelegate. We've got to reform the superdelegate. I mean, so it seems to be like wide understanding, broad understanding of it, because it causes, frankly, more problems than it solves. The big problem that it should solve is that it is an emergency break.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, their power lies in the media narrative of people being, sloppy about it.
People they like to have power.
Of course.
And not every congressman. There were a lot of congressmen who've stepped forward. They've signed our letter in support of the reforms. But some, it's just, they love it. They say it. They openly say it. They're like, we earned this. No, you walked into your congressional seat, you know, Joe Crowley. What did you earn?
Exactly. All right. Well, let me ask you. I mean, I want to broaden out just for the past week, and I appreciate that insight into that process because I think it is so much like toxic crap came out of the whole process with the DNC that spun out in multiple directions, it seems to me, that I think incredibly unhelpful, particularly at this time.
Can I make one more point about that?
I'm sorry,
before we move on. I also think that while superdelegates are tremendously important, they're not the root problem with the Democratic Party right now. And they've almost become a distraction, whether intentionally or not, I think both, away from the issues like where's the money going, are states parties being supported, how are you going to win back these races? And also, like, there's a privatization effort. Like, there's outside organizations who are doing the work of the DNC right now and with no oversight.
Well, let me ask you about that, since you have insight into it, because what we're talking about is really, on one level, first order problem is distinct from politics and ideology. Mm-hmm. It is really just a systemic. It's just that you have an institution that has become sclerotic and corrupted in many respects, and because no one's really been paying attention to it in some way. Like, people are making money. No one's going to lift up the lid and look in there and see what's going on. And that is completely distinct from an ideological. I mean, there may be some things may track it. Like, you know, if you have people who really think that money is the ascendant value and I get into a system, that's what I'm going to pull out of it. But in terms of the way that I think most people understand politics as, you know, a function of issue sets and this and that. Mm-hmm. That's not what they're there for. They're there because they're enriching themselves.
Yes.
It's a lot like, almost like in some ways, local politics.
Mm-hmm.
How wide is the understanding of that? What is going to deal with it? Because, you know, there's multiple forces where you have, like, the Obama people really wanted to maintain control, it seems to me, of not so much the machine. Like, I didn't get the sense that the Obama people wanted, because they were making the money from it, as much as, like, we don't want the party to move in a direction that we sort of think is politically wrong. But they were willing to maintain an apparatus that is inherently dysfunctional. I mean, it seems like, you know, I mean, it's just by definition of it's losing races across the country in races that in an environment where it shouldn't have. I mean, 2008, we should have been able to get rid of, like, there shouldn't have, people would have to look in the history books to see what a Republican Party is. I mean, theoretically, if
we had been
if the party apparatus had been functioning the way it should have been. So how do you dislodge that? Because it's really basically what you're trying to do is keep people from making money the only way they know how. And people tend to, like, in my experience, hold on to that very tightly.
Yeah, especially if their identities are attached to it. And
of course.
And no one's ever looked into, you know.
So I mean, this is a problem that people have, like, in businesses, too. Like, how do we get rid of this culture in this business?
Yeah. So this was my pet issue. Maybe some of your listeners and viewers saw the video that went viral, the last commission, where I basically had a meltdown and I dropped an F-bomb on the floor. Well, the backstory on that was, first thing, it was after 8 months of debating this, we just come out of a room where we had an agreement on one of my resolutions. Then we went onto the floor, and all the other side, they started questioning it. And so right before me, Gus Newport, one of our appointees, he said something very powerful, and he said it was ridiculous. And then it was my resolution, so I just, you know, flipped the heck out. But I think you have a couple issues here at play. Human nature. People want to keep their money, and this is what they've attached themselves to. And there's a lot of people who literally failed up in Democratic politics. In fact, I'd say the majority of consultants out there are just failing up and giving really bad advice. So if you plan on running for office, you know, most of them are full of shit.
And let me just say this, I mean, just so that people understand sort of what intersects with this conversation. I interviewed Ryan Grimm about his piece in The Intercept, which talked about DNC and DCCC mm-hmm. representatives coming into campaigns, often choosing the wrong people, and sort of bigfooting the local people in many respects. There was another report by Theda Scotchbull and Lena Putnam mm-hmm. that showed the same dynamic. Not with the ideological differences. I mean, you're talking about people who might be, you know, sort of, just sort of mainstream Democrats, but also feeling the same way of like, hey, wait a second. You know, the people are coming in and they're bigfooting us and they're not listening to people on the ground who have a sense of what's going on in the district. And so it's there. You have these stories of a dysfunctional system within the party that I think is less ideological and more sort of like systematized, right. There's got to be some business management term for what the problem is.
So I think it's intentional. I'm at this point in the game, and I think if I had said this 2 months ago, I'd been called a conspiracy theorist. I think at this point in the game, it's so clear that this model doesn't. The model doesn't work, but then it's so clear that some of these people and these ideas, after being called out so openly, they're being exposed and they're still doing it. There's some other thing happening. I'm going to rewind a little bit. In the late 70s, the Democratic Party purged union. They literally made a decision with the yes. DLC. The DLC, I'm not fucking around here when I say this. I can say fuck, right?
Yeah, but not okay. The DLC, not the Democratic Leadership Council.
The DLC... This is important. The DLC, one of their earliest investors, this is in the 80s, though, was right. The Koch brothers. But it was yes. all around that time.
But this is 1980.
1980, right.
Now, in the early 70s. In the early 70s, unions were pushed to the sideline yes. by the McGovern Commission. In right. fact, that's where the yes. whole superdelegates yes. reform came from, because they didn't want it the back room, and they didn't right. want just the union heads to be. And there was yes. an attempt to move towards the suburbs, and we've done a couple of interviews on that over the yeah. past couple of years. But yes, but in the 80s,
there was this movement, right?
There was an idea of like, we need more corporate money.
Exactly. So you had the purging, the actual DNC members being purged, the union members being purged and replaced with corporate members. I don't think they legalized lobbyists then. I think that was later. But
Tony Coelho. Yeah, right. Okay. So go ahead. But
love that guy. So this was all happening, and at the same time, the centralization of the DNC happened. So what does that mean? It means that the DNC is no longer putting all of its money into state parties. And, you know, it was the death of the clubs. I mean, there were clubs everywhere, precinct captains. It was an investment in neighborhood Democratic politics, which really was hand in hand with unions. If you think right. about unions, I had a friend of mine say this the other day. He's a consultant, and he was trying to find somebody for somebody's campaign. I'm not going to say who. And he is a very good consultant. Like, there's not many, but he's kind of like the guy that you call for help in the end. And he said,
there's no infrastructure.
There's no infrastructure. He goes, there's no talent. There's no talent being groomed. And he said, it used to be that the unions worked with the Democrats on this. And when you kill unions, when you kick them out of your party, when the Koch brothers are going after them state by state, now, I mean, the Janus ruling,
right.
whatever's left to them, you know, these were the organizers.
Right.
These were the precinct captains. And at the same time, the Democratic Party decides they're only going to focus on presidential politics, which is a multi-billion dollar industry. The only time we kind of went back was in 2006 when we won the House.
And we should say these decisions were made at a time where the Democratic Party had controlled the House for 40 years.
Yes.
There was never a time, you know, and these guys, I don't know if you appreciate this, there was never a time where the Democrats did not control Congress for in the entire post-war yep. period. And so they felt like, we don't need to do anything right. about it. We don't need this infrastructure. We got to play this game of like 30,000 feet. We'll deal only with the president because we'll never have to worry about Congress. And of course, in the mid-90s,
which
then that falls apart.
Is insane. So unions are being attacked.
Certainly in retrospect. I don't know. I don't know at that time if some type of redeploying of your, you know, I can understand why someone might get cocky over 40 years, like, we got this. And
I mean, listen, but Governor Cuomo has accepted more money from the Koch brothers than Scott Walker did.
Right.
At some point, we just have to sit there and say to ourselves, is the tail wagging the dog, or is the dog, I mean, like, this is it's not that the Koch brothers invested in state parties because the Democrats were no longer investing, which is the message I kept hearing. I'm hearing, why the hell did the Democrats stop investing in their state parties and weaken the party? It's basically disaster capitalism for the Democratic Party. And then as a result, they have these all these private entities where they bring the billionaires in and the Democracy Alliance, and there's no oversight. Right. And suddenly the billionaires know better about electoral politics. And, you know, the new Eric Holder Obama group to protect legislatures. Where the hell were you over the last 8 years? You essentially didn't pay attention to the DNC and the DLCC. Whose job that is?
Right. Let me tease out what you mean by this disaster capitalism. No, I mean, I think this is a really interesting point. The idea being that once you deplete the infrastructure, the sort of the disaggregated infrastructure that is, I don't want to get overly dramatic, but more democratic and dispersed, and it's hierarchical because it's a system, right. But it is staffed, it comes from communities,
yes.
Up, and it populates it up that way. And once that's gone, then you come in and say, like, oh, well, we need an infrastructure. The only way to get that is to buy it. Mm-hmm. And we're going to buy it with a huge amount of money. We're going to, you know, come from outside of town, and we're going to build it from like that, which is exactly, you know, the model of disaster capitalism. And all of a sudden now the authority shifts from the local people and the infrastructure to the big money people who have just parachuted in. And they're also, not only is it bad in terms of who has control, but it also is repeatedly less effective.
Yeah.
And we've seen that. And we've seen that dramatically. And simultaneously, on the right, we've seen the growth in particular of, and I think this is why it's, you know, of mega churches and of religious institutions that have filled this void. And then a huge amount of money that comes in from the Koch brothers. And the way they spend money is pretty adept. Like, they spread it around like, you know, we're going to, 1,000 flowers are going to bloom.
And they're strategic. They're very strategic about where they're investing, who they're investing in, who they're. I mean, listen, Scott Walker, they
groomed him from exactly. Like when he was like county, I don't know, yeah. A dog catcher or something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They wage wars in areas that they know they can win. We don't do that as Democrats. I will say there was this brief period, obviously. It was over a decade ago, but in 2006, when we won back the House, there's no coincidence that, and granted, there was an anti-war movement and a lot of stuff was happening. And
corruption was the big, anti-corruption was the big thing.
But we also invested in every state under Howard Dean CNC. Dean 50,
yes.
And there's this book, what is it called? It's Lindsay Marks. He was the former finance director of the DNC during that time. And he talks about the inner fundraising, like the rise of fundraising in the Democratic Party. And it's fascinating because at the end of the book, there's this moment where he's discussing Senator Schumer, Rahm Emanuel, and Howard Dean sitting in the room talking about this program to invest in states. And Rahm Emanuel at that time, who was a congressman at the time, was also the head of the DCCC. And he was fighting with Dean about the 50-state strategy because he goes, why invest in states when we're not competitive states? Why should we invest there? And to me, that's the essence of this, of their argument, is like, why should we spend our money everywhere when we could just spend it in a couple of places? But that's based on an assumption of the DCCC understanding what that district is going through. And what we're seeing is places like John Ossoff. What?
Right.
How many million? $40 million? What was that?
Right.
$40 million on that race for somebody who, like, basically didn't grow up, wasn't even from there, had no, you know, was a staffer. Nothing wrong with being a staffer, but, like, milquetoast, boring.
Well, right. I mean, John Ossoff wins. It's not really going to change the tide of anything. It's not like we're going to install, like, it's Tip O'Neill.
Yeah.
And he's just been out of office for 2 years. We got to get him back in.
Right.
It's not, like, even winning doesn't seem like the return on investment, even if he wins, doesn't seem that high.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a real it's a real problem. And I wonder, give me your sense of, I guess it is to break that logjam I mean, is there another way to go around it? Is it you know, something like the DSA on some level seems to be, I mean, it doesn't have the nearly the resources, you know, to compete, but it has a, I should restate that. In places where it's strong, it clearly has resources that aren't necessarily dollar-based, right? There's services in kind because you have motivated people. But that's not an answer for 2018
for every election,
2020.
Right.
I mean, it's what is the answer? Is there an answer? And
well, we do have to reform the DNC. And while the DNC is not the DCCC or the DSCC, it helps that if we actually flip the model the way that we've been pushing, and I do think that there's an appetite for that in the DNC membership. And I want to make that, a lot of people
there's
are like
470 members of the DNC.
Yeah.
Is that what it is?
I think so.
Let's just call it 450 for the sake of argument. How like aware are these people? Because most of the people I meet who are members of the DNC are not like, they're not, you know, Darth Vader. Like, right. I think there may be a couple of Darth Vaders in Washington.
There are. But there are definitely some Darth Vaders in the DNC. But there are also a lot of good people. Good people who understand their districts. They ran for DNC. They are involved. They're involved. Not as many union people anymore. But I would say this is the way I break it down when I try to explain to people where the DNC stands. It's not like this entity, that this megalith, like they all think the same way. That's not how it functions. It's a diverse group from all 50 states and the territories and abroad, Democrats abroad. And they, I would say there's 35% of the DNC have conflicts of interests. They're lobbyists. They literally make money off the DNC. They've worked at the DNC. They're in and out.
That to me is like the typical, like, I live in a small town, I'm going to join the United Way, and the United Way needs to print some flyers. I happen to own a printing company.
That's exactly.
I mean, it's basically that type of dynamic, right?
Except the guy who's printing the flyers wouldn't be on the board of the United Way. Or it's pretty sad when Goldman Sachs has more board oversight than the Democratic Party does over its executive committee.
Right. And what's the way to reform that? Is it simply to reach those 450 people and say, you got to vote for somebody different?
Yes. But also, the recommendations that we have actually address a lot of these reforms. So this was Dr. Jim Zogby and I were on the reform, the party reform committee, and we pushed for transparency, budget transparency. And when I mean budget transparency, I don't mean a pie chart that's what they use.
Right.
They use a pie chart. And they're like, well, our budget's transparent. We spent all this money here. They don't say how much money's come in, where they're spending it, who are the consultants, are there bid contracts?
So there's just no proper oversight.
There's no oversight. It's a joke.
And if the 450 members of the DNC had the proper oversight, that they would be fixing this.
And they want it. I think that the majority of them want it. What we saw with the DNC chairs race, it was very close. Don't forget that first ballot.
Right.
Tom Perez won it by a half. One and a half, because Democrats Abroad is a half. 1.5 votes. And then it moved to the second ballot. And, you know, some shenanigans happened behind the scenes beyond the president calling people on the floor. There was some other stuff that happened. But that was when, I mean, the party was split then. I think that we probably have more people on our side, especially after a win like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I think a lot of people are starting to see that the current model is not working. But these are like the insiders. They're still insiders.
Right.
So they're still, even though they might be moved by the people and have personal opinions about things, some of these folks are worried about making the chair upset. There's still that institutional establishment mindset. And that's what we have to overcome.
All right. Well, look, we got to take a... Well, no, we don't have to take a break. Let's just go and start doing some audio. We don't have we got some more clips here. That stuff, I think it may be dry for some folks. I think it's hugely important because your outputs, you know, there's two things that function your outputs. That is your inputs, and which I think people are working on. And is you know, much better. We're seeing, you know, a lot of candidates. We're seeing people come out and vote in, mid-year primaries like they never have before. But if your function that black box is messed up, then the outputs get screwed up. And it's there's a lot of we can't afford to waste energy or resources right now,
right?
Because it's such a crap show.
And donors deserve it too. I mean, billionaire donors are one thing, but people who are giving to the Democratic Party deserve to have their money used. I mean, they're investing in the party because they want Democrats to win. And whether it's Emily's List or the DCCC or HRC, all of these groups have a responsibility to the small dollar donors just as much as the big donors.
Yeah, I agree.
I want my $27 back.
Bernie? I think that was a good return on investment, no?
Yeah, okay.
DSA now has a surge, right?
Yes, it's been pretty big for us, so I'm not going to turn my nose up at it.
Well, along those lines, let's listen to Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez on Colbert talking about how, I mean, in many respects, look, I think voters are a lot more engaged, at least Democratic voters are a lot more engaged than they have been at this part of a cycle, you know, as far as I can remember, frankly. Mm-hmm. And I mean, even in 2006, much of it was literally about a scandal with a Republican congressman who was like a predator on pages,
right,
and was being covered up by the Republican leadership. But that was not the case,
nope,
in this election with Joe Crowley. And here's Ocasio-Cortez explaining how she had a sense that there was something going on with the electorate.
Mm-hmm.
I obviously, you're a very capable, intelligent person. Why do you think you were able to swing 51 points in 3 weeks and unseat this man and been there for 20 years?
Well, I think the first thing to kind of mention is that I don't think polling is always right.
We learned that in 2016. We learned that in 2016.
You know,
yes.
Polling, here's the big thing. Polling, people try to identify who is the most likely person to turn out. And what we did is that we changed who turns out. And that changes the whole election.
Well, who turned out? Who doesn't turn out? Who doesn't turn out, especially for Democratic primaries? And who turned out for you? Who are your constituents?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. We were about 8 minutes till the polls were closing. And I was in my home neighborhood in the Bronx. And these two young, oh yeah, BS, we got any BS out here? and it was 8 minutes till the polls closed, and these two, like, teenage-looking kids came up to me and was like, "We just voted for you." And I was like, "How old are you?" And they're like, 19. And I was like, "Oh, 19 years old voting in an off-year midterm primary election?"
I was watching footage of her, you know, before the show today. And if she was, I mean, speaking of young, right? I mean, she's 28. Matt, right? She's just about your age.
I'm 29.
Well, but if she was 3 or 4 years older, I would not be shocked to have her picked as the vice presidential nominee in 2020. I mean,
I would.
Literally not eligible.
Yeah.
To do that, she will not be old enough.
Oh my gosh, you're right.
She will not be old enough to do it. But the idea at age 28 that she has this poise, this savvy, and presence, I think is nuts. I mean, this was multiple things coming together, which was good politics.
Right.
Like, she had a good issue set. Demographically, she reflected her district in a way that Crowley was no longer doing.
That's true, but that's not why she won. There's a lot of misinformation being set out about that, which I'll explain why that's a thing, yeah.
And three, she's a great retail politician.
100%.
Right? I mean, but tell me demographically that she's, I mean, she's not... give me your take on it.
Well, okay. So I live in Queens, and I'm friends with her. So full discretion,
Disclosure.
Full discretion here. Talk about not sleeping for 3 days. So she's from the Bronx, and the Bronx, for those of you who don't know, is the Bronx and Queens are the most diverse places in the entire world.
Yes.
Number one and number two. Used to be Queens was, now it's the Bronx, and they've switched positions. They also have these machines, as I've mentioned, that are very, very invested in keeping the vote down. So keep that in mind.
In fact, I don't know if specifically these districts, but the pre-clearance counties before the Supreme Court gutted our pre-clearance in the Voting Rights Act included at least some districts in Queens and Bronx, which people don't know. They just assume it's all southern states. But Queens and Bronx were places where there was enough of a history of racial discrimination in access to the vote that they had to go through a pre-clearance process with the DOJ before the Supreme Court blew it up.
And now it's just with our voting laws.
Right.
It's with our voting laws and the machines of these counties, in the Bronx in particular, it's very complicated, and I don't want to go down that rabbit hole, but there's an interest in keeping some people who are making a lot of money off of kind of not representing their own people, and not necessarily in office, but people who are running the machine there, consultants. So Alex, while she's Latina and while she speaks Spanish and while she's Puerto Rican and she understands and she's from the district and she really gets it, the changing demographics in the Bronx too, but in areas like Astoria, where I live, gentrification is not the right word for these parts because they were white, but it's like a new white,
right.
A different working class white, because that's what Crowley, why he was elected, was he had the Irish, the
right.
White voters of that generation. But these are all Bernie voters. And the Bernie voters organized and they turned out. And that's what happened in that district. If she didn't win that demo, she wouldn't have won. And so when I say the
creative class, almost like the cousin to the creative class, is that what you're saying?
I mean, because it's not like they're wealthy. They're not,
right.
I mean, I'm not like, I'm unemployed right now, so.
But I think the creative class was not necessarily about money as much as it was about sort of, you know, I don't know, the
philosophy.
New economy or philosophy or something like that, I guess.
Yeah, and a lot of them are DSA members. There's a very strong, I was at the Queens DSA meeting last night, and, you know, there were a lot of new members that were there. But aside from that, the reason why I mention this is because both Nancy Pelosi and Governor Cuomo were like, you know, what happened in that district is it's an anomaly, and it's because she's a Latina and she got the Latino vote. That's not why, first thing, that's not why she won. She did obviously get the Latino vote, but it was because she got this other vote and she was talking about intersectional issues.
Right.
It is fantastic that she's a person of color, a woman, a millennial, a socialist, a working class person. I went to this restaurant called The Coffee Shop the other day, which is in Union Square, and I just happened to have a meeting there. And this guy heard us talking about politics and he goes, you know, Alex used to be a bartender here just like 5 months ago or 6 months ago. And I got chills because that person is now in Congress representing us. And she didn't get elected because she was Latina. She got elected because of her ideas. And she was able to use those ideas that transcended the entire district. And that is the model that's going to work. I don't care what Nancy Pelosi says. That is not, it was not because she was Latina in a Latina district.
Well, all right. Let me restate what I meant by demographics. She was not an old white guy.
Right.
I mean, that's.
But
that's
old white guys work too. Bernie won in that district.
That's true. Fair enough.
Sorry, I don't mean to like.
No, no.
The people who voted for Bernie are such a good list to have when we're working on other campaigns because they're so receptive to it. It's awesome.
Yeah.
If the candidate delivers. I mean, if the candidate delivers on that promise.
Yeah. Also, I think you talk about intersectionality, like she's doing a really good job. Like there's been this sort of false dichotomy advanced, I think, by a lot of centrist liberals and like a few people on the left as well. That, you know, you have to choose between class politics and identity politics. And there are people who really believe that that's going to hurt the left if we try to do both at once. And I think that's ridiculous. Like, she's made a really good connection between the two. She's been really good at that over and over. And definitely did a better job than Bernie. So good for her.
Oh, absolutely.
And there's clearly, I mean, there's also clearly a dynamic that's going on electorally that I think the all things being equal, the median Democratic voter is pulling the lever for women over men. I mean, I think just sort of like right now, that is, I think it is all other things being equal. I think that that appears to be a legit phenomena.
I hope so. I mean, in New York, what's fascinating is just a couple of days before this primary, and let's not forget, New York has two different primary dates.
It is so confusing. So unbelievable that I literally had a week, like 2 weeks ago, I was like, shit, man, we got to get Cynthia Nixon on before the primary. Yeah. And I was like, wait a second.
I had a reporter ask me the day of the election, what, how do you think Cynthia is going to do? And I was like, it's June.
And that's by that's by design.
Yes.
That's why New York has two counties that were in the pre-clearance provisions of the national of the Voting Rights Act, because it's effed up here.
But think about this. Just a couple of days before the election, there was, I don't know if you'd agree with this, but there were a bunch of hit pieces on groups like Our Revolution and these activist groups who haven't been able to deliver. They haven't won the majority of their elections. I'm sorry, let's just look at the DNC for a second, and Emily says in DCCC, like, have they won the majority of their elections? But there's another standard for the new organization run by Nina Turner, who's an outspoken reformer. Okay. But with that being said, Emily's List did not endorse any of the women that ran, except for literally the day before, Luba Gretchen Shirley in Long Island. And all three of those women that ran, one who had literally run against the establishment, the DCCC, like recruited somebody, all three of the Our Revolution women won big time. And they weren't expected to. So something's going on. First thing, I always think that on the front lines of the revolution, there are women. And they never get the attention, and if so, they get smeared, like Nina Turner gets smeared, or Susan Sarandon, or Rosario Dawson was during the campaign, and so many of our other sisters, they're not the same as the chosen ones, I guess. So I think this is extraordinary, and in a place like New York, where like you could not run in a more difficult state, and they won against the establishment, that means a lot.
Well, on some level, let me just add that the bars, and there's, I don't know, there's an analogy in terms of, like, you know, what's happened with the gerrymandering, right? Like, if the Democrats get above a certain amount, then everything just falls apart for the Republicans. But that threshold is higher because of the gerrymandering. But in this instance, there's also the difficulty involved in voting generally favors the incumbent because there's a sort of a baseline disinterest. In this instance, the depth of support, not just the scope of it, not how many people, but how deep that support runs, like what an average supporter was willing to do relative to an average supporter in any other year, was so much greater that that became an advantage for candidates like this. But the Emily's List thing too, I would just add, is like back in the day, Jane Hampshire over Fire Dog Lake, you know, I'm going way back now, would describe some of these groups as being in the veal pen. That they would, that there are some groups who go in and they just basically go in and they're there, they fatten themselves up, and it is really more about maintaining access and power within Washington. So that they lose sight of their original mission. And on some levels, I think there's like criticism of Emily's List that I think is legit in that regard. In a big, big way.
I mean, when you're when organizations don't support you because you're not viable, and viability, the definition of viability is, can you raise $250,000 in 2 months? And by the way, in some cases, these candidates did. And that's when you're like, okay, so it's not even this bullshit excuse of having to raise, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars right away to get your endorsement, early money. Then you actually do, based off of grassroots donations, and you're not supporting this candidate. What's the real shtick here? Is it just because, oh, they're talking about economics, that's why.
But do you think that there is a mechanism in which viability can be measured by outside groups an effective long-term way, or as opposed to like, look, what we're going to do is we're just not going to get involved in primaries. Like, I mean, like,
I think it's the worst idea
to not get involved in primaries. So how does an outside group that is based in Washington, raising their money, how do they assess a race in, let's say, I mean, take for instance, the 19th. Okay. where I have spent the better part of the past 10, 15 years. No idea. I had no idea. Look at that field. I had no idea who was the most likely. I mean, I got a sense of, like, you know, what politics I liked of individual, but I had no sense of which one of these people could actually win the district. Now, the turnout was like, twice or than it was the primary with Zephyr Teachout and Will Yandick. Now, you have four times the amount of candidates practically, but there's obviously a lot of enthusiasm on the Democratic side. So maybe you don't have, maybe there was four people in that race who could win. Right. But I don't have a sense of who could be, who would be the best candidate. If I had to go in there and give money to, I wouldn't know who to pick if I wanted a win out of that district.
Right. I don't think you get involved in every primary. You know, in full disclosure, I do work with Our Revolution. So, but the model of Our Revolution is, it's evolving, right?
Right.
They have a board. All organizations evolve, but they're based off of, they take their recommendations from the local groups. And the local groups, I mean, this is what the Democratic Party should be doing, right?
Right.
They should be listening to the local chapters. I was actually a little surprised that Our Revolution endorsed Alex nationally, because a lot of the other chapters around the area hadn't. But there was one chapter, which Bronx Progressives, which is an Our Revolution affiliate, which stepped up and said, you know, we have to support her. And they took the recommendation from Bronx Progressive because they're in the district. They were involved. They were volunteering. They had the feel of the, you know, what was happening on the ground. But it was a risk because Our Revolution is also challenging Governor Cuomo. And, you know, sometimes you have to sit there and say to yourself,
is it worth expending our political capital on this congressional race against somebody in the leadership? Or do we want to save our powder for the big fight against Cuomo?
And you know what?
It worked out.
It worked out.
Right. Doubled down and worked out.
Oh, my God. I was shocked. Yeah.
All right. Do we have a Jimmy Reefer Cake song?
Oh, my God.
The excitement.
Did he write one for Nomi?
I don't know that he wrote one for Nomi. I don't think he knew that Nomi was going to be on. But,
you guys didn't promote me.
We better get him on that for next time.
Jimmy Reefer Cake needs to do a Nomi Const theme song. Did you find it? Did you find it? I actually remember now, I did see it earlier. Now, Jimmy Reefer Cake, most weeks, writes a song that reflects the week in news and also reflects his desire for marijuana to be decriminalized across the country. And he's actually had a tremendous amount of success. I don't know if it's because of the show, but he's been doing this for about 6 years. And marijuana has become significantly more legalized across the country.
Coincidence? I think not.
Right. And so this week's, do you have this week's? No. Oh, we should also tell you that he has been on a Doors parody kick. So this week is,
it's called DA Woman.
Yes. So based on
that's
LA.
Oh my God.
Here we go. Deal.
Yeah, all right. All right. Come on and tweet it out about an hour ago. She threw a look around, see which way the wind blow.
Oh, my God.
She said legalize weed at the federal level. Are you the lucky little lady gonna legalize? Or just another lost bill. I didn't legalize it. Legalize it. Legalize it. Legalize it. Come on. DA woman. DA woman. Getting high on Sunday afternoon. Driving through your suburbs, saving them booze. Yeah, saving them booze. Yeah, telling the truth. Just saving them booze. Oh, yeah. I see your weed is burning. Bongs are filled with fire.
that reefer is bad.
He's already laughing.
You know they are a liar. Driving down your freeways.
Hey, you may have to
totally fucking stoned. Yeah, alright. Drunks in cars coming home from bars. Dave and Eddie driver should be totally stoned. I say let him be totally stoned. Right.
Yes.
That's brilliant.
There we go. I assume he's taught DA woman is Kamala Harris, right? I mean, that's. So there you go. DA woman. By Jimmy Reef.
We need a box set of the Doors covers, I think.
Yeah. We could put that out. I mean, of course, I'm sure Jimmy's selling it on allthehypocrisy.com, where you can go to get more of that. All right.
Once again, definitely an improvement over the original.
Folks, just a reminder, you can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Every day we give you free content. You can support that by becoming a member. And to say thank you, we give you more content. And if you're one of those people who can't afford to become a member, but you want the extra content, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Wait for 10 days while we catch up on our emails, and then we will hook you up. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use your coupon code majority, get 10% off. We're going to head into the fun half. Before we do, don't forget the Antifada, Jamie's co-hosted podcast.
Yeah, so we finally dropped this amazing crossover episode with Brett from Revolutionary Left Radio. It was also our anniversary that day, me and Sean, my co-host.
How long have you guys been married?
We have been married for a year. We've been together for 8 years.
Seriously? Wow. Just a year?
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Very exciting. What do you do on your first? Was that like a silver, a gold, a paper, a...
It is a record a podcast anniversary for us, I guess, because that's what we did. And
well,
it was
very romantic.
It was very romantic. And we also talked with Brett about, because he's a dad, we talked about how his parenthood has affected his politics and his political philosophy, and kind of brought a tear to my eye.
Right, because isn't one of the underlying themes of Antifada, Sean, trying to convince you to start a family?
It is. It is indeed.
And where are you with that right now?
You know, maybe he needs to bring on a few more prominent leftists and we'll talk.
Wow. I don't even know what that, I didn't have to diagram that.
We talked to Doug Henwood and Liza Featherstone about having kids. They've got a kid.
And what is the general consensus, would you say, on the left in terms of having kids?
I mean, we do need to build an army of red diaper babies, so that's like a pro. And also, it kind of lights a fire under your ass, because once you have kids, you're like, oh, shit, the world is fucked. I need to do something about this, which sounds like equal parts inspiring and terrifying to me. So I'm still like kind of on the fence.
Yes, I can attest.
Can I share a personal story real quick? Because this is, I'm very conflicted about this response. I went on a date like a couple of days ago, and for some reason we got a conversation about kids, not like, you know, our future.
Well, that is quite a date.
It was a very, very intense thing.
It was the first date.
Yeah. But both of us were like, why the fuck would we bring kids into this world? It's actually on fire. Like, it's actually, there are parts that are exploding. And who's going to survive? It's going to be like the Trump Aryan race. So not our kids.
I find it somewhat a concern. I mean, but I don't know. Well, I'm not going to tell my Ambien story again. But Patreon.com/TheAntifada, or of course iTunes.
Wherever, I need to listen to this now.
Hell yeah. Wherever free podcasts are sold.
And
you can give us money if you want to.
Do you take Bitcoin? I'm kidding. I hate Bitcoin. I hate them.
Oh my.
And Literary Hangover.
Yep. Patreon.com/literary hangover. Also check it out on YouTube. The episodes are going up there, and there might be some, I think we're going to record some bonus content for the Patreon members maybe this afternoon. So hopefully it'll be up this weekend.
Ooh.
But Sleepy Hollow coming out next Saturday.
Sleepy Hollow.
Wow.
Do you want to explain what the podcast is?
Yeah, for anybody who hasn't heard, we read fiction. It's sort of a book club podcast, but with an extra eye on sort of history and politics. That sort of went into the formation of the book and how it was received and that sort of thing.
Love that. There you go.
I don't know if I ever read Sleepy Hollow. I don't know if I read it or I cliff noted or I just lied on my
It's
exams.
One of those stories that sort of permeated the culture so much that you've probably picked up most of the elements.
Okay, that's probably it.
Oh, I just saw that Alex. Oh my gosh!
Yeah. What?
Whoa!
What happened?
Oh, let's put this up. Wow! So, Infowars.com.
Oh my God!
There you go.
Wait, can I take a picture of this and just?
Well, it's on. It's on Twitter.
Oh my God!
Infowars.com. Has a new foil, apparently. Meet the face of tyranny and suffering. It's pretty funny.
You know, but that's concerning because InfoWars is dangerous.
And yes, that's true.
You know, she's a very accessible, I'm actually concerned about this, especially in light of like what happened yesterday.
If you think Venezuela is awesome, you'll love Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Believes in flooding America with illegals who vote, overthrowing the Constitution,
oh my God, this is so horrible.
Disarming all citizens, never-ending government handouts for all.
Well, that's
true. Like talking about flyers. class tribal warfare against whites, government-run third-world health care. She should really go out there and promote the best health care, not third-world health care. I think it's probably...
Government monopoly.
Government monopoly over education. I mean, I would say probably the government has a monopoly over education already. I mean, right? I mean, on some level, I don't know if you would run an antitrust case against the government in terms of monopoly, but okay.
I certainly
hedge
wouldn't.
Funds?
weakening police while gangs run rampant.
Gangs, yeah.
And then, of course, the results, mass starvation, total brainwashing of children. If you're going to brainwash children, folks, do it totally. Don't do it partially away. It just confuses them. The collapse of individual liberty, government genocide. There you go.
Man. You know, I wonder if she could do something. Like, she's not in office yet, and she is a public figure, but I wonder if there's some way she can go after him legally.
She's a public figure.
Well, that doesn't mean you're cleared. I mean, defamation, there are actual effect. I mean, if this has some sort of maybe there's legal experts here, but defamation isn't just extinguished because you're a public figure.
I mean, you would have to prove that when they say that she believes in flooding America with that they know that she's not. The bar would be like you would have to prove that you know that she's not believing in overthrowing the Constitution.
Class tribal warfare against whites. I know that she's not.
That's probably.
I think that's provable. She won the whites.
She won the whites. She's just going to use them to bludgeon the other whites. That's what she's going to do. All right. We're going to take a break, head into the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number. We'll take your phone calls. We'll take your IMs. We're still working on the app. Google had some issue with our app, so it's available if you have the
Our
app.
Ideas are being suppressed by the tech companies.
Totally. We've been deplatformed. But majorityapp.com. We'll be right back after this.